A warning to listeners or readers. The following content may at times include details about abuse, rape, suicide, domestic violence, and other types of trauma that may be emotionally confronting or triggering.
Welcome to Raised by an Invisible Village, where we unbundle the incredible power of the people who influence our lives. I'm Kathy Houlihan, your host, who will be guiding you on a very personal transformative journey. My personal story of uncovering the diverse characters that made up my invisible village, who together enabled acceptance, growth, and success. At the time of recording this episode, we have been on the road in our caravan now for 3 weeks. Our first week, we based ourselves at a beautiful place called Bulwillimbah, located in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales. This gave us the opportunity to stop and plan our next 12 months of travelling around Australia, after a manic 6 months of renovating our family home. We also used this time to drive by various locations, including Benora Point, Kingscliff, and Tweed Heads. This area is loaded with memories, some good and some bad. It was where I had lived with my then violent ex-husband over 20 years ago, before together with my two sons, we had to escape in the middle of the night to Emerald, an outback town in Queensland. The second week of being on the road was meeting up with my father and mother-in-law at Nambucca Heads. For me, Nambucca Heads did not represent any personal significance. However, it did provide a safe place that I could really start working deeply into telling my story. By now, we are also settling into our caravan life, the start of our 12-month adventure. The next location we stayed was Riverwood Downs. This was and is a place of very personal meaning. When I was 16 and pregnant with my firstborn son, I stayed here for several months with a beautiful couple, Chris and Val, prior to giving birth. That moment in time proved to be a monumental sliding door moment that allowed me to change a life pathway that could otherwise have proven to be very different. Stay tuned for this episode. This week, we are staying at Budgerywoy, an absolutely stunning location on the central coast of New South Wales. Ocean on one side and a huge natural lake on the other side. It's cold as we are now well and truly into winter, but the sun is shining and provides warmth through the window of our caravan. Every morning and night for the past 3 weeks, the sound of kookaburras early morning and evening can be heard. Sometimes there has just been one, but many times there have been many more sitting either on the trees or power lines outside our caravan. If you haven't heard the sound of a kookaburra, they start with a small, quiet cackle, then slowly open their beaks to the sky with a crescendo that becomes louder and louder, faster and faster. They then join with other kookaburras to create this choir of cackling, a beautiful, calming sound. If you Google the spirituality of a kookaburra, you will find that they have a potent healing energy, and their appearance in your life may signify a period of deep healing. This healing is not just happening for you, but people around you, creating a healthy ripple effect that positive changes are to come. How appropriate as I lean into this episode and again reminded of my purpose to tell my story with rawness, not overlooking the power of those that were in my invisible village, but the responsibility we all have as a character in other people's invisible village. February 1985. I am now 13 years of age, no longer a virgin, smoking, swearing, and living with my boyfriend. Oh, and let's not forget that I'm disfellowshipped from the Jehovah's Witness. School is back, and how I made it to school is a little unclear, but nevertheless, I somehow did. Again, something that remained consistent during that time of my life. It was a Tuesday night, quite specific, I know, and for some reason I had a fight with my then boyfriend and decided that I would go uptown with his friends. They were all male, and while I don't remember all of them, I do remember one. "Kathy, come back," my boyfriend yelled out as I disappeared into the night and down the road with his friends. I'd only known them for a few days or weeks. It would be the first time that I would be introduced to alcohol. We sat on the town end of the old Catherine Rail Bridge. It was obviously a meeting place of some sort, and as I remember, lots of people coming and going. I really had no idea what alcohol could do to your body. I'd only ever had a rare sip of beer or wine. My mother and father never really drank alcohol. And on the rare occasion that they did, we were allowed a tiny sip, which we would screw up our face in disgust at the taste. So here I was, a cask of wine, My body would have been very underweight having spent the past few months homeless, so I would assume that it wouldn't have taken much for me to become well underway to being intoxicated. "The cops are coming, the cops are coming," someone yelled out. I remember being dragged up and over the old Catherine Railway Bridge. My memory of this moment in time becomes blurred as I trip and hit my head. The lights that were by now dulled by alcohol were completely out. I woke up on some sort of couch or bed. Looking around, I become aware that I am in a small cabin. A man speaks and says, "It's okay, you're okay now." I start to panic though, and I ask to go back home to my boyfriend. The man says, "Okay, I'll take you." We step out of the cabin and I have absolutely no idea where I am. There didn't appear to be anything around us. No houses, just this cabin in the middle of nowhere and a dirt track outside. As we start to walk out onto the dirt road, I start to realize that I am a very long way down the road on the other side of the Catherine River, a very long way from where we'd been drinking. I wondered how I got there, and I wondered why I had no underpants. I was sore and bruised all over my body. Nevertheless, I asked the man to let me go as he seemed to have hold of my arm. We continued to walk further down the dirt road, and then out of nowhere he pushed me over into the spear grass growing on the side of the road. Spear grass grows to over 2 metres in the Northern Territory and it is really, really prickly. The man proceeds to tell me that he rescued me from 10 guys and it was now his turn. I'm not going to go into the details. I don't feel that's required, but you get the picture. Yep, right. When he is done, he gets up and he lets me go. I looked around at my surroundings as the moon was shining really brightly. Somewhere in that moment, I had the foresight that in the event that I needed to tell the police, I had a few landmarks and awareness of where I was. And then I started my long walk back into town. I'm going to pause here for just a moment. As you can expect, this moment in time is so challenging to talk about. It is actually a place that I don't consciously go back to, although there are times unconsciously a smell, noise, or any other type of trigger may send me back. I remind myself this is no longer happening to me. And I can hear the sound of the kookaburras starting their cackle, joined by other kookaburras. A spiritual, metaphoric sound like a beautiful choir. Sitting in the trees, their beaks pointing to the sky as they let out the joy of their voices. This spiritual bird is telling me that profound healing is taking place, not just for me, but for other people hearing this who have or know someone impacted by rape. I'm right where I need to be, my purpose for telling my story. As I continue my walk down the dark dirt road, which seemed like hours, I finally arrive at the Stuart Highway, the main road that runs through the centre of Catherine. I cross the main bridge, walking in the middle of the road, hoping that a huge road train would come in either direction and end it all. This would be my second attempt of suicide. But a road train didn't come. The streets of the town were deathly quiet. No cars, no people, just the silence of the early morning darkness. I walked down the street where my boyfriend stayed, opened the back door, found the room that he was in. Everyone was asleep on the floor, including the guys that I'd joined up with to drink at that old railway bridge. The following morning, I showered and borrowed my friend's clothes. She lived in the same house, and off I went to school. I sat with my group of friends, and they asked what had happened to me. My entire body, legs, arms, and face were covered in bruises, cuts, and scratches. My only explanation was some white guy had grabbed me. Later that afternoon, I was called to the front office of the school, and there waiting for me were two police officers. I remember being very scared as I knew that I was underage for being drinking alcohol. But no, it wasn't about that at all. I was taken to the police station and asked a whole bunch of questions. One of my friends had told her mum about what had happened to me, and given that she was a health worker, reported the incident to the police. I was then taken to the hospital and underwent a forensic medical examination, a very degrading experience to say the least. After the hospital, I was then taken back to the police station. My entire body was photographed and then question after question, which went on for about 8 hours. There were massive blank spaces in trying to detail the entire previous night's events, and the police were trying to link it all together. From the moment I hit my head and was dragged over the bridge, I couldn't remember how I ended up in that man's cabin. During questioning, I suggested that perhaps if I went back to the railway bridge and try and retrace my steps, that perhaps I would remember. They agreed that this would be a good idea. So with a handful of detectives, we arrived at the northern end of the old rail bridge. I stepped down to try and walk across, only to discover that the length of the bridge, which was about 100 metres long and 23 metres below was the river, that the entire bridge could only be described as completely derelict, full of gaping holes, rotten sleepers, and the only thing still intact was the iron of the railway tracks. I remember looking at it and thinking, how did I ever cross that and not fall below? Falling below would have been instant death. And as I looked back to the detectives and moved myself away from the edge of the bridge, there was absolutely no way I could retrace those steps across the rail bridge. We continued up the long dirt track to where I could remember the man, the cabin, and the spot where he had thrown me into the speargrass. They poked around in the speargrass with this little stick, asked me more questions, and then I was back in the police car back to the police station for more questioning. At one stage, I remember seeing my father through a window at the police station. I wondered why he was there. Shortly after the police interrogation, I was in the temporary care of my friend's mother, beautiful lady who kindly allowed me to spend the next couple of nights in their home. Somewhere during these days, I was told that I was being sent to live with my auntie and uncle in Melbourne. I had never met these people. My uncle was my father's twin brother, and all I knew about them was that they were not Jehovah's Witnesses. The next challenge for me was spending a four-hour drive from Katherine to Darwin in the car with the family. By now I am completely traumatised. The consequences of being in that mentally wicked tornado had taken its toll, not only on my physical body, but by now my mental health felt like it was non-existent. I was numb to the world. I don't recall any of the flight from Darwin to Melbourne, but I do vaguely remember getting off the plane and being greeted by my auntie and uncle. It was a freezing night. Well, leaving the extreme humidity and the heat of the Northern Territory to arrive at night in Melbourne in February 1985 was a huge shock. My uncle and auntie lived just outside of Melbourne in a rural suburb called Lungwarren. This is where I would spend the next 6 months living. I took an instant liking to both my auntie and uncle and found it difficult to believe that my uncle was a twin of my father. They were both incredibly different in both looks and personality. The first night in my new home, despite freezing outside, it was warm inside. I had my own bedroom, an electric blanket, and an incredible feeling of safety. The morning light, I was able to see that my new home was on acreage, with a huge horse dressage arena and two horses out in the paddock. How lucky was I! Horses were always something that I loved, and I would often dream of one day having my own horse. My auntie and uncle had two children, both a lot older than me, and were no longer living at home. For me, it felt like I was an only child, far removed from being the eldest of five kids in a noisy, chaotic house, and of course the mental tornado that had been my life for the past 6 months. I was no longer moving from one park bench to another, or different houses almost every night, to now somewhere where I felt safe, welcomed, and accepted. As an adult, I look back at this time and think how amazing that my auntie and uncle, together with both my cousins, had been critical characters in my invisible village during this time. In that moment of bringing me into their home, their own children had left home. They had no idea who I was. We had never associated with any of my father's family, and they definitely had no awareness of what the past 6 months had been like for me. My cousin Kay, who at the time was living with her boyfriend, would call me her little sister. Something that was amazingly comforting, and given that both horses were hers, she actually gave me one as a gift. During the first few weeks of relocating, I was able to re-establish my relationship with my auntie in Perth, and we wrote to each other at least a couple of times a month. I'd be so excited to receive her very, very long letters, and we would also talk on the phone. Well, I probably did a lot of the listening. She was the talker. I'm not clear on how long I'd been in Melbourne, perhaps only a week, when there was that phone call. I remember coming out from my bedroom, down the hallway to the kitchen, which is where the landline was situated. My auntie always sat on a stool, pen in hand, doodling on a pad when she spoke on the phone. This time, though, my auntie was standing with her back to me, and I could tell from the tone it was not a good phone conversation. She hung up the phone, turned to me, Her face looked like she was in complete shock. I instantly was anxious, not knowing whether to stay or go, and she summoned me to stay. Barely able to get the words out, my auntie started to tell me that the results of the rape forensics had come in, and the results indicated that I had been pack raped with 10 identifiable specimens. I had also contracted chlamydia and needed to go to the doctor immediately for treatment. I hadn't at that time, and for many, many years after, any memory of that particular event amongst the other events of that night. The mind has an amazing way to protect significant trauma. It is actually called dissociative amnesia. In later years, vague memories appear, and in most instances are triggered by a smell or a situation. However, my disassociation from events mean that I see and feel as if I am watching a movie, a third person. The weeks and days after receiving that phone call, I was seeing doctors and psychologists. Again, very vague recollections. However, I do recall the doctor indicating that the length of time that I had been infected with chlamydia meant that it would impact on my future of having children, and I had psychologists telling me how I should start behaving as a consequence of rape. My auntie and uncle were now confronted with a lot more than they had been briefed from my parents. In later years, they told me that upon the request from my parents to look after me, I was described as going through a rebellious stage, and it would only be for a couple of months. The situation was significantly more. A 13-year-old, severely traumatized, and had been living on the streets for the past few months, and now there was welfare, police, detectives, doctors, psychologists, and now an impending court hearing to be held in Catherine. My auntie and uncle could be described at the time as middle income, both worked, beautiful rural home on acreage, horses, two cars, and their own children who had left home successfully starting out in their chosen careers. My auntie had grown up in a protected home with loving parents and one of four girls, a close family that would have seemed to have been a healthy, functioning family unit. And then here I was. It was far from what they had ever experienced, and it would have been incredibly overwhelming. I am not sure if my parents at the time just could not communicate the severity of not only their situation as parents, the embarrassment would have been huge, but to then also have to explain the significance of the situation that I was in, it would have been just next level. Or perhaps the mental tornado had just moved so hideously fast that for anyone trying to keep up with events that unfolded over a six-month period was just impossible. Nevertheless, my auntie and uncle would have been completely unprepared, inexperienced and overwhelmed. However, through this period of time, I only ever felt safe, welcomed and unbelievably supported. There were many nights that my auntie would spend hours talking to me, hugging me and wiping away my tears. There is so much more to the next phase of this part of the story. The mental tornado of chaos of the past 6 months had definitely slowed pace and was losing momentum. However, I was now entering into another storm. Only this time the safety net of my invisible village was really emerging. My auntie and uncle, along with my two cousins, were and still to this day remain a significant part of my invisible village. What would have happened to me if they hadn't said yes to me staying with them? What if they had immediately sent me back to my parents once they realised that I was not just a rebellious girl? A lot of ifs. They only showed me love, support and acceptance. And I'll be forever grateful. As I close out this episode, I can hear the kookaburras starting their cackle as the light of the day starts to go down. A familiar sound that again provides me confidence and comfort that I'm okay to share my story with you. My profound recognition that those who were in my invisible village at that time of my life were many diverse characters. That I'll never truly know all of who they were, but contributed in some part to my recovery. I invite and welcome you into the next episode of my story, Raised by an Invisible Village, creating a safe and connected space for you and I. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the series Raised by an Invisible Village, and these real life stories have provided you with the opportunity to reflect about your own invisible village, a moment in time to uncover those who accept you, support your growth, and celebrate your success. and the recognition that you also are a character in someone else's invisible village, and how important our roles are as mentors, influencers, and champions. I'd love to stay connected and encourage you and others to join me by subscribing to my podcast channels. Together, we can continue to recognize the power of our invisible village for acceptance, growth, and success.